All right. You are listening to Timeless Voyager Radio if you are surfing your dial and don't know what happened here. My name is Bruce Stephen Holmes. My guest this evening is Dr. Alan Snow, author and speaker. He is the world's foremost authority on the Dead Sea Scrolls, and we are going to talk about things like religion, the Bible, fact, fiction, so on and so forth. Welcome to the show, Dr. Snow.
Thank you, Bruce. Glad to be on.
Let's start with that situation. Now, I noticed that you sent me some very interesting information, and I like to mention it to the listeners because they should know. The first thing I noticed here is that in Sidney Omar's Astrological Guides, 1994, 1995, and 1996, you are cited in all of them.
That's because he picked up my letters to the editor and some articles that I'd written on the astrological and the horoscope sections of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And you know that these sections are mentioned in the scholarly journals and in the scholarly books that you can only find in seminaries, but they're not, this kind of information isn't filtering down to the general public. And I do believe, in line with the format of your program, this is a conspiracy. This is a conspiracy by our theologians, our religious teachers, not to let us know what's really in the scrolls, because they will cause us to doubt the historicity of our faith and the validity of what's been taught to us in our Sunday schools.
Let me ask you a question.
Yes.
How are you using your phone? Because I'm getting a little bit of feedback here.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's much better. I don't know what you did, but please do that.
I didn't do anything.
Okay, well, whatever you didn't do, continue.
Okay, well, I didn't do anything. Okay.
Let's see. The book your church doesn't want you to read. This is another book that you have a very interesting article in, and that one is astrology in the Dead Sea Scrolls. You look at astrology a lot, and you are also part of a book called Answer in the Sky, Almost, which is another one by Sidney Omar. So your area, I guess, of expertise, or what you really like to talk about, is the Dead Sea Scrolls and astrology.
I really like to talk about the Dead Sea Scrolls, because there's so much more there, especially when you talk about first century Judaism and the origins of Christianity, because I think that these areas are what's really important in the future study in the scrolls, because I believe that the scrolls show that Christianity, for at least the first 135 years of the Common Era, you know, A.D., Christianity was a totally Jewish religion. It was not a separate religion. They weren't kicked out of Judaism by the rabbis until after the second revolt of Bar Kokhba, and it wasn't really so much for religious reasons, like, you know, believing that.
Now, what year frame would that be?
Pardon?
What time frame? What year would that be?
Oh, we're looking at the second revolt would be 135 A.D.
So that's 135 years
after Jesus,
right?
And the reason that the Christians were kicked out then was because they had become too much of a Gentile-type religion and had not supported the Jewish revolt. Before that, they were a totally Jewish religion, which was part of one of the Jewish sects of Judaism at that time, which was far more diverse than it is today. And this is what's been brought out in the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Dead Sea Scrolls are valid as historical documents up through the Second Revolt, because scroll material was found in the Bar Kokhba material.
All right, let's talk to our listeners for a moment and tell them a little bit about the scrolls and what they actually are.
Okay, the scrolls were found in 1947 in what was Jordan, and they were quickly sold, you know, on the market to interested parties. So the first cave, seven scrolls, two of them went to Israel right away, and then the other five were sold on the open market here in the United States by Syriac archbishop. These quickly got the attention of scholars, and the majority of the scrolls ended up at the École Biblique, which is a Dominican Catholic graduate school for biblical and archaeology studies in Jerusalem, under Jordanian control at that time. Since these theologians didn't know really what they were doing at the time or what they were dealing with, they had some graduate students some Protestants, mostly Catholic, come in and sort out the scrolls and translate them. And they've been pretty much in control of the scrolls for the next 40 years. And you're talking about over 800 separate documents, books.
Now, these documents, from what I understand, are on some are on kind of like metal, I guess it is, and some are on paper, and some. I mean, is that correct?
They're on parchment. They're on lambskin and goatskin, because that's what they wrote on in the
desert.
No metal, huh?
They
had their herds of goats.
No metal. So that was...
They used metal for one of the scrolls. Oh wait, they had some other. They had a silver scroll that was very small, not very significant, and it was just a passage from the Old Testament that was written on a very small silver piece. But the metal piece that you're probably referring to is the copper scroll, which was a treasure guide for about 60 sites of hidden treasure that was possibly the gold and silver from the temple at that time that was hidden in 60 sites throughout Judea so that the Romans wouldn't get it.
What is it that the Dead Sea Scrolls hold, let's say, that somehow... becomes a problem with the with Christianity as it's being practiced today?
In the Dead Sea Scrolls, you have first century material that has not been edited, rewritten, revised by either rabbinic sources, later rabbinic scholars, or by Christian clerics. You have genuine first century material. It covers the time from 200 BC to at least 67, 70 AD, when Titus was invading Judea and destroying the area during the first revolt. Possibly these go up to 135 AD because you have Dead Sea Scroll material in the Bar Kokhba material. Now, what you have in here is first century material that describes, for all practical purposes and to anybody who can read the original documents, and you can get the documents in translation now, they're available in the market. You have a Nazarene community. They call themselves the Notzri Habrit. And this is from 200 BC up to the time of Jesus. You have a community that, like the first century church, and church is just another word for congregation, first century church that called itself the Nazarenes. They had the baptism for the remission of sins, which was a first century Christian practice.
So they had the baptism
200 years before Jesus.
Right,
yes?
I was just going to say it, okay.
They had a communal meal of bread and wine at which only, it was called the Messianic meal, at which only the members of the community could attend. This was a service, a Messianic service that was celebrating the coming of the Messiah, and this was to be celebrated any time they had 10 members together. So you could have this maybe every day, once a week. Whenever you had 10 together, they celebrated this meal, and they sat in order of, a Levite priest at the head of the table, and then, depending on your status, you sat away from the priest. But those who were in attendance were to partake of this service of bread and wine, which is a service that is 200 years older than Jesus and his service of Holy Communion of the Last Supper. You have a community that calls themselves the Nazarenes, who held all things in common. This is a very unusual thing. No Christian church I know of today holds all things in common except the, David Koresh cult or something
now,
like that.
Now, what exactly does holding all things in common mean?
It means when you join the community, which was the Notzrim Habrit, that's what they call themselves, that means keepers of the covenant, the Nazarenes, if you joined that community, you went through a probation period, you gave everything that you owned to the Mabakar. The Mabakar is the Hebrew word for bishop. Our word bishop comes from the Greek word episkopos. It means overseer. Mabakar means overseer in Hebrew. Overseer in Greek is episkopos. In English, it's bishop. You had bishops who were overseeing a community of Nazarenes 200 years before Jesus supposedly ordained the first bishops of the church, namely the 12 apostles. You have in the Dead Sea Scrolls a community that was headed by three priests and 12 laymen. The three priests were selected by the community because of their great learning and also because they were sons of Zadok. You had to be a priest, descendant of Aaron, to hold that office. And the 12, the members of the Council of 12 would be 12, you know, honored members that were scholarly and deserved the position. And this is before we had anything like Peter, James, and John heading up the church in Jerusalem as being the head of the Council of 12 Apostles. 200 years before the 12 Apostles, you had 12 Apostles heading up a Nazarene church or a congregation in Israel.
So I guess what you're saying, and as you are basically using as the bottom line, the backdrop here, the scrolls, have all the scrolls been translated?
No, absolutely not.
There's
about 800 manuscripts. I've been told that there might be as many. I've been told by Jim Tabor, Dr. Jim Tabor. He's one of the Dead Sea Scrolls scholars, quoted and writing on the Dead Sea Scrolls all the time in the archaeology magazines, that there could be as many as 1,200 or 2,000. And a lot of these scrolls, nobody knows where they are. You know, when the Bedouins were stealing this stuff and selling it on the black market, they didn't sell everything. You know, some of this material is now known to have ended up in private libraries. At least one book of Enoch is supposed to be in Kuwait in a vault that's held by a Kuwaiti wealthy man. Dr. John Strugnell was one of the last editors of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Before he crashed and burned, and that's a very interesting story in itself. He's seen this scroll. He says it's true. And I know that I just read a book by, it's called The Hidden Scrolls by Neil Asher Silberman, who is a major scholar in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And in his interview with Archbishop Samuel, who is one of the first black marketeers who bought the scrolls from the Bedouin, smuggled them out of the country, sold them in New York, to the Israeli government, and the Israeli government took them back and built the Shrine of the Book for them. He has little scraps of Dead Sea Scrolls, sections of it, little fragments, in his own private collection. Now, who knows what he has? He might have major material. He might have stuff that's worth nothing.
So the information that we have, coming back to what I started to say, basically is saying, according to what you are saying and what a lot of people who have studied the scrolls say, is that the entire story, the entire scenario, the entire Christian,
Christian
Bible.
What you and I were taught in Sunday school and what we read in the book of Acts is late material, I'd say about 200 AD. Much of it is fictionalized and really... so inaccurate that many scholars today in Bible studies don't even use it. It just doesn't fit reality, and the parts that do fit parallel what's in the Dead Sea Scrolls. For example, the parallels that I've already described of holding all things in common, and if you didn't give all the things that when you joined the community of Nazarenes, if you didn't give everything, you were severely punished. And you remember the story of the couple that was sold a house and gave it, presented it to St. Peter. And he asked, well, where's the rest of it? And they said they gave it all. And he says, no, you withheld. And then they dropped dead. That's in the book of Acts. The punishment in the Dead Sea Scrolls for deceit and for lying and for lying to the bishop are very, very severe. And that's the way it was in the New Testament. And that's never made sense before. But it certainly makes sense now.
All right. So what I'm trying to say then is that the most important point here, the stuff that is really rocking the quote-unquote Christian Bible, is that according to the scrolls, the information that the Bible basically is based on is not only inaccurate, but most of it is fictionalized.
Yes, it really is. You find from the Dead Sea Scrolls that things that are explained a little bit better. For example, I've used the word Nazarene many times so far. Jesus was called Jesus the Nazarene. Now, if he was Jesus from Nazareth, you know, he would be called Jesus the Nazarene from Nazareth, right? But he's so often called Jesus the Nazarene, born in Bethlehem. In Jewish terminology, you're named after the place of your birth. It should be Jesus of Bethlehem, not Jesus of Nazareth or Jesus the Nazarene. What I think happened is that a later writer inserted this material in the gospel stories, and he wasn't very familiar with the term Nazarene. He didn't know how it was used in the early church. He thought it referred to Nazareth. Now, modern biblical archaeologists have discovered that Nazareth didn't exist at the time of Jesus. There wasn't a city or town of Nazareth during the time of Jesus. Today, there's a city of Nazareth near a town called Sepphora, I think it's called. And that town, it was a major, what would you call it, major Hellenistic town. It's a town that was very foreign to the Jewish experience. And Jesus would have grown up there, or at least close to there, if he was anywhere near that area.
What happened at the council at Nice then with the Bible? What exactly went on there?
Oh my God, you're way late. The Nicene Creed. You're way up into when the
I just want to use that for
church
a second.
Solidifying its the Orthodox Church was solidifying its grasp on the empire religion. See, what you had in around the third is 300. You have Constantine adopting Christianity as the religion of the empire. Under him, the bishops, the Orthodox Catholic bishops, started what is today the one Holy Roman Catholic Church under their authority, with the head of the worldwide religion being in Rome. Before that, you had five patriarchs. You had the Patriarch of Alexandria, the Patriarch of Antioch, the Patriarch of Jerusalem, and the Patriarch of Rome. Rome was a major center, so the bishop, the Christian bishop, by the year 300 in Rome, was one of these major four patriarchs. When Rome became the religion, when the Catholic Church, or the Christian Church, before you know, it was Catholic, became the religion of the empire, the bishop of Rome set himself up as first among equals. He became the bishop of the whole church. Not all of the other patriarchs agreed to this. That's why you have Eastern Orthodoxy. They went their separate ways, and then when Rome, later on, under Byzantium, the Byzantine Empire, moved its capital to Constantinople in Turkey, the Archbishop of Constantinople became the Patriarch of Constantinople, the first among equals of the Eastern Orthodox Church.
I know. My question was, were the Dead Sea Scrolls around them then at that time, and were they being hidden?
Okay, that's an excellent question. In the 3rd century, Origen, which is one of the early church fathers, discovered, when he was visiting Palestine at that time, discovered Hebrew and Greek books in jars near Jericho. Jericho, of course, if you look on a map, is right there, right next to Qumran. And later, around the year 800, Timotheus, the Nestorian Patriarch of Seleucia, reported that manuscripts were brought to him from the caves around Jericho, and he didn't know what to do with them either because he wasn't a Hebrew scholar. But this kind of went on and on. And up until the time of 1930, the caves were being looted by the Ta'amira tribe of Bedouin Arabs, and these artifacts were being sold on the black market. And when there were Jewish settlers there in the 1930s, refugees from Germany's bad experience of the time, they were offered tours out to the caves to see where the books of King David were stored. And so
no one really knew what was in these. They just knew that they were artifacts and wanted to collect them and buy them.
That's right. They had no idea that these things were valuable. They were sold on the black market to anybody that wanted them. You could use them, you know, for bookmarks, or you could use them for, you know, just frame them and put them in your house if you did that. They had no idea of their real value.
For listeners that may have just joined us, tell me, what are some examples of information that is found in the scrolls, something that is absolutely different from what we read in the Bible? Now, you gave that example, for example, example three times in a row. You gave a very good example when you spoke about the Lord's Supper as being actually practiced 200 years long before Jesus entered the picture. Are there other things that are just as incredible and amazing?
Okay. There are things in there that are interesting that shed light on the Bible. For example, the expression "preparation of a way of the Lord in the wilderness." You know that appears over and over again in the community rule. And as you know, St. John the Baptist, when he was baptizing in the Jordan, which if you look on a map, you'll see, Jordan drains right there into the Dead Sea, right near Qumran, which is only 15 miles outside of Jerusalem. So you can see this isn't an area that's isolated from mainstream Judaism, as most Dead Sea Scroll scholars would like you to believe today. They weren't isolated at all. You could walk 15 miles, today, and it wouldn't be a big deal. You have the, this little problem of, remember Jesus said something about lifting a cow, he was asked, if it was proper to lift a cow out of a abyss if he falls in it on a Sabbath. That was a big concern, in the New Testament. Well, that was a major concern to the Dead Sea Scrolls, too. In the Dead Sea Scrolls, in the Damascus Rule, you find an expression that could have come straight out of the New Testament. Says, no man shall assist a beast to give birth on the Sabbath day, and if it should fall into a cistern or pit, he shall not lift it out on the Sabbath. Well, Jesus said the exact opposite. He said, if it falls in, what man would not lift it out? I suppose at one time you may have wondered, why did John the Baptist eat locusts in the wilderness? Well, in the Damascus Rule, there's even a recipe for eating locusts. It says, and as for locusts, according to their various kinds, they shall plunge them alive into fire or water, for this is what their nature requires. And this is, part of a paragraph that describes how to eat certain birds and animals, blah, blah, blah. And I thought that was a very interesting idea that parallels the New Testament or reflects light on the New Testament.
Okay, let's look then at the Bible and the revealing information that comes from the Dead Sea Scrolls. I've heard that the idea that of sin does not come from anywhere except we start hearing about it somewhere around Paul. Up until then, we had never heard of the concept of sin. Is that correct?
Up until St. Paul?
Up until Paul.
No, the Bible's full of sin. The Old Testament is full of sin.
No, okay.
In fact, King David, his biggest problem was sin. And prophets would come to him and tell him that he sinned when he took Bathsheba for his wife away from his Hittite general. That was a sin. Sin is what the Old Testament is all about, from the time of Adam. The first sin was, mythical sin, of course, first sin was Adam and Eve disobeying God and eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And so it's been sin ever since. That's what the prophets have been yelling about, sin, mm-hmm. fornication, idolatry. These were all sins. Sin, is falling, short of God's command. That's what sin is.
But I guess what I wasn't very clear about that, and what I meant by sin was that I had understood that according to the Dead Sea Scrolls, Jesus really did not have much to say about sin. He didn't say that he was, for example, the only way that a person could live after they had sinned. They didn't have to ask him for forgiveness. All they had to do was just two basic things, and that was to honor God. And to honor themselves and their neighbors. I mean, love was basically all he was about. All that other stuff evidently came from Paul. Is that your understanding?
I understand the question now. Now the thing is about sin. Did Jesus forgive sins, or did he say he was the only way to be forgiven? Okay. The modern, I'm a member of the Jesus Seminar, which is a very liberal organization. Modern biblical scholars would say that, no, Jesus would not say that he can be a sacrifice for sin. Because, even during the time of Jesus and the early church, you can read this in the book of Acts, even after Jesus died, the early church was still attending temple. And at temple, there were still the sacrifices going on for the sins of the emperor in Rome, and for the sin, the different bulls and the doves were being sacrificed for this sin and that sin. There were prescriptions for if you did, this or that kind of sin, you were supposed to sacrifice this or that kind of animal. Now, in the Dead Sea Scrolls, there's a very short section called the Prayer of Nabonidus, and that's found in the fourth cave. And he's a pagan king of Babylon. And the interesting part about this is that he's talking about a Jewish mystic who came to him. And he writes in this prayer, this Babylonian king writes in this prayer, a very short sentence I'll read to you. And an exorcist pardoned my sins. He was a Jew from among the children of the exile of Judah. Okay, just that sentence alone shows that in the Dead Sea Scrolls, an exorcist could pardon sins. And that's what Jesus was doing. Jesus, if he existed at all, was most likely an Essene, Jesus the Nazarene. Now, I don't want to say the word Essene because, you know, the word Essene never appears in the Dead Sea Scrolls, nowhere. They refer to themselves as the meek, the poor, the keepers of the covenant, the Notzrim Habrit, you know, this Nazarene word that we never seem to be able to translate into English. We always have to use the Hebrew form. Jesus was most likely an exorcist that was very much like other exorcists running around town at the time, between the 15 miles of between Jerusalem and Qumran, healing the sick and preaching the coming of doom. That's one thing about the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's full of doom.
Doom.
We might want to talk about that later.
Doom and gloom, huh?
Doom and gloom. Yeah, they believed without a doubt that they were living in the last days. When you read the Dead Sea Scrolls, you're reading about a first century Jehovah's Witness movement who thought that they were going to live to see the coming of the two messiahs. The two messiahs are the Messiah of Aaron and the Messiah of David.
That's very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, they weren't expecting one Messiah. That's another thing about the Dead Sea Scrolls. They were expecting two. One would be the servant in the temple. They never planned on giving up temple worship. The Messiah of Aaron would be the temple high priest, and he would be there for a long time, if not forever. And you had the Messiah of David, who would lead them in victory over the next few years against the whole world. The whole world would be dominated by this community in Qumran. All the wicked would be destroyed, all the Egyptians, all the Romans, all the Greeks, and everybody else.
This is very similar to the idea of Revelations and the rapture.
Oh, yeah. When you consider certain books, like the book of Revelation, the Epistle to Hebrews, and the book of James, if you just took out the very few words in there that are very Christian, you would have Essene material.
That's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially what we're looking at is we are looking at a very interesting collection of work. But the Dead Sea Scrolls are not necessarily any particular direction, are they? They're just a recording by, are they recorded by different people, or is it recorded, well, it's not recorded by the same person, is it?
No. They used a lot of material that's borrowed from Jewish groups that were operating in first century Judea. You have a lot of the material, of course you have the Old Testament, except for the book of Esther. And many scholars today believe that Esther's not there just because it's an accident. They just didn't have that book in the material for no bad reason. It just wasn't there because they had other sections in the Dead Sea Scrolls which are called Tales from the Persian Court. And there were similar stories of the Jews being in Persia during the Persian captivity under Cyrus the Great. And they got along just fine with him and ended up coming back to Judea. Because they were such good people and got along with them so well.
So these are essentially just journals, maybe historical journals about what was going on at the time.
Okay. I described the Old Testament that they had, which is basically the one we have. They had also many of the books that's called pseudepigrapha. Now, pseudepigrapha is a name that modern theologians have given to denigrate these books that were part of the Essene Qumran canon of the Bible. And these are, extra books of Ezra and Enoch, the Book of Jubilees, a lot of the other stuff that we have today from other sources. For example, when the canon of the Bible was, the Jewish canon was canonized around 90 A.D. by the rabbis, and this is after the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 A.D. They went to Yavneh. And the rabbis decided they were going to, you know, systematize everything and make it, you know, just right for the future of Orthodox Judaism. And they chose to reject what's called the pseudepigrapha because they didn't think they could use it. They just didn't like it. But the Essenes accepted many books of the pseudepigrapha. And then they had a lot of other books that are not in our present pseudepigrapha that are totally original to either them or what they borrowed from other Jewish sources in Egypt, Babylon, and Jerusalem. These other so-called biblical books that have the names of early prophets that are not in our present canon.
Dr. Snow, let's talk a little bit about, let's finish up this pseudepigrapha first. That's false writings. And then let's go on and talk about the Nicene Creed if we have some time.
Okay, the false writings, like I said before, that's what modern theologians call books that were rejected by former, let's call them censors. They're not in the Bible now, but they really, really probably should be, and I think that you'll be seeing maybe a movement
so these books,
by modern theologians,
these are the books,
especially people in the Jesus Seminar,
right,
to add them.
These
Pardon?
Books, okay, let's talk about these books a little bit. Right now, people who point to the Bible as their base for their religion say the Bible is the Word of God. Everything that's in the Bible is the Word of God. Anything that is not in the Bible is not the Word of God. Now, we talked about the Council at Nice. We talked about, we didn't talk too much about it, but I mean, obviously a lot of stuff was thrown out. For example, I understand the term reincarnation was thrown out a lot at the Council at Nice. The point here, from what I understand, is that there must be a lot more to this idea of the Word of God. There must be a lot more information that just has been edited. This thing must be almost like the Reader's Digest condensed. I'm having trouble with my mouth tonight.
That's
condensed
right.
Version of religious information.
Okay, in the Council of Nice, the major problem there was to solidify Catholic doctrine. It was their job to put out a creed that would be universal. So they put out what's called the Nicene Creed. And that's the one that every Catholic, Lutheran, or Episcopalian, or Eastern Orthodox Christian says almost every time he's at public worship. This is the Nicene Creed. And it affirms the Trinity, the divinity of Jesus, that he'll come again, that he was born of the Virgin, and that the Catholic Church is the only authority on the earth. Okay, a lot of these things are a great departure from what the church was, and I'm talking about the Jerusalem church, the first century church of Jewish Christians under the leadership of James the Just, who is the head of the church with Peter, James, and John. Peter and John as his assistants over the 12 apostles, and he was there up until the time he was killed, a little before 60 A.D., and it's believed by early Christians of that time that one reason that Judea fell apart under the rebellion was because the Jews had arranged to kill James the Just, the leader. I don't believe that, by the way. That's just what's in the early Christian literature. But James the Just was such a major figure that even in the history, early history of the church by Eusebius, James the Just was the major reason for the fall of Judea in 70 A.D.
Now, I don't remember him at all.
I know. Well, that's because the church history has been revised. You now have the great Catholic Church, which I was born Catholic, later Episcopalian. But you have the Catholic Church who teaches that Peter was the first pope. Peter was the head of the church in Jerusalem. There's no evidence for that at all. Not in the New Testament, not in early church literature. That's all later stuff.
So essentially, again, we're looking at hindsight. People
yes.
just kind of said, this is the way it was, put it in a book, said it's the Word of God. That takes care of anyone questioning it.
Well,
right?
if one accepts a certain religious authority, then that would be the final answer. But when one goes back into history, especially since 1947, when the first Dead Sea Scrolls were released to the general public, one can now see an evolution of church history and an evolution of religious doctrine. It didn't just all pop out of Jesus' mouth, you know, in the year 30 A.D. and between 30 A.D. and 33 A.D. When he died. All of this stuff can be found before him. And I remember when I was studying Hebrew and Jewish history at University of Judaism in Los Angeles under the rabbis there, The New Testament came up a lot. Not that I brought it up. I didn't care. I was Episcopalian. But it was brought up a lot. And it was shown that much of the best of the teachings in the New Testament had its origin in the teachings of the rabbis of that time.
You told me to mention cave number 7.
Okay, the cave number 7 is one of the most interesting caves because it's filled only with Greek documents. See, the other 10 caves, see, there are 11 caves in all, the other 11 caves have Hebrew documents and Aramaic documents, which is, you know, when I studied Hebrew, you know, if you read Hebrew, you could read Aramaic. They were in Hebrew, but this cave 7 had only Greek documents, and among the biblical documents, it had what you would expect would be a Greek document for the Bible, the Septuagint Bible, which is the Hebrew Bible translated into Greek in Egypt, and it became the Bible for the Greek-speaking Jews throughout the world. Now, the major problem with Cave 7, and you'll never hear about this anywhere except from me right now, is that many of the fragments there have been identified with books of the New Testament. A scholar, a Jesuit scholar, who studied the Dead Sea Scrolls, he teaches at a major Catholic Bible Institute, Dr. Jose O'Callaghan. O'Callaghan, you heard it right. He's a Spanish Jesuit with a very Irish last name. He has found 19 Greek fragments, and he has traced them. You know, he's taken the Greek letters and has found that they are from 1 Timothy, part of Mark 6, Mark 4, Acts 28, Mark 12, James 1, Romans 5, 2 Peter 1, and Mark 6. And can you imagine that?
Now, what does this mean? Tell me what this means.
This means that in Cave 7, you have an anomaly here. Anomaly means something that should not be in first century material. You have, you expect to have the Septuagint first century material. That stuff is hundreds of years old. But to have New Testament writings in the Dead Sea Scroll fragments, and not even to hear about it, you know, why that's not front page news is incredible, because you will find mention of these fragments, even though they don't have the fragments themselves. There's mention of the fragments in the Dead Sea Scrolls in English, 4th edition, which just came out this year by Geza Vermesh. This has all the major published Dead Sea Scrolls for anybody that wants to buy it. It's 1995, the Dead Sea Scrolls in English, Geza Vermesh, and the last name there is Vermes, pronounced like SH. That's major. These fragments are mentioned in Joseph Fitzmyer's book. He's a Jesuit scholar on the Dead Sea Scrolls. His book is called Responses to 101 Questions on the Dead Sea Scrolls. He mentions O'Callaghan. He mentions who supports him. There's academic scholars who support him. And then, of course, there's the mainstream scholars who oppose any kind of idea that connects the Qumran community, Christianity that's older than Christianity, to Christianity, if you get my drift. Anything that upsets what we were taught in Sunday school is to be ignored or just denounced. And that's pretty much what has happened with this material. James Vanderkam, who doesn't believe
some examples,
any connection between the New Testament church and the Qumran community and Jesus, has a short chapter on the scrolls in the New Testament, and he has several sections in here that discuss O'Callaghan's connections and writes them off, but he does mention them. This stuff is available, but it's not touched. In the last edition of Bible Review, the December 1995 edition of Bible Review, which is published by the Biblical Archaeology Society, it's a very liberal and up-to-date journal, has a whole section on gospel among the scrolls, written by Graham Stanton,
This is the same place where the information in Time magazine's article draws their information.
Right. Almost everything in the Time magazine that's out this week comes from scholars who are connected or write for the Biblical Archaeology Society, which publishes both Bible Review and Biblical Archaeology Review.
How about some examples now of this revealing information? You ran off a number of verses from the Bible, perhaps you could give us some ideas of what we're looking at here.
Do you want to have, like, where they're found in the Bible?
Well, maybe just an overview of what we are actually looking at. Maybe just take one or two examples and say,
okay.
Here, okay.
Okay, the Mark 52 through 53 almost parallels cave sevens. That's, you know, it's called the 7Q5 document. So that'd be, you know, cave seven, Qumran, fifth fragment. It's verse 52 goes, and let's see, for they, the disciples, meaning the disciples, that's in little quoties there, did not understand about the loaves, but their hearts were hardened. And when they had crossed over, they came to land at Gennesaret and moored the boat. So you have words in the Dead Sea Scrolls. You have them in the order that they would appear in a Greek New Testament that you would be studying today. And the words that appear are about, there, and Gennesaret, you know, part of that word, and moored. You know that kind
of
coincidence.
Let me see if I can. I want to understand it
on the scale that I've described is incredible. 19 fragments.
All right.
You know, if it was just one fragment, you can say, "All right, the guy's made a mistake," but he has found. And for anybody that's taking notes, I'll read you just an example.
Well, wait, before you do, I want to understand this. Are you saying that this information supposedly, I'm really confused here. Are you saying that this stuff was written before it should have appeared in the Bible or
oh,
after?
Oh, no, no.
What are you saying?
This stuff was hidden away, according to the best authorities, in the Qumran caves just before the occupiers of Qumran had to leave because the Romans were coming there around 68 or 70 A.D. So this is plenty of time for all of this material to have been written. You know, most modern scholars today will tell you that most of the New Testament is written maybe 100 or 150 years after Jesus, you know, A.D. You know, like I have 2 Peter, you know, a modern scholar would tell you, well, that wasn't put together until around 150 A.D.
Well, what about this idea of the letters to the Corinthians? I mean, I thought these were letters that were written while they were in jail.
Yeah, that is supposed to have happened. You know, this is where the fundamentalists, you know, our friends out there, the Christian fundamentalists, I call them the fundies, will love this. Because if this is true, and I think it is, because I know that the major scholars are trying to distance Qumran from early church doctrine and history. If this is true, then this proves that most of the New Testament, or at least these books of the New Testament, were written within the time frame of the real authentic New Testament. That would be, you know, before 70 A.D. when the Jewish Christian church or congregation or Nazarenes, if you want to call them that, were finally destroyed and dispersed by the invading Roman army. Of course, they weren't that destroyed because some of their material and their people were found with the Bar Kokhba revolt in 135, you know, which ended in 135 A.D. So that's, you know, you're looking at almost, 60 years later. This material is major. It's a major discovery. It's a major, this is a major article appearing in a magazine that reaches about 200,000 people. But you'll probably never hear about it, and I think that's very strange.
Dr. Snow, I guess I don't want to belabor this point, but I'm just a little confused. I want to try it one more time.
Okay. I'll try to give it a simple answer.
You know, it'd be interesting if the listeners were able to get through, someone would probably be able to say whether I don't know what you're talking about or not, and they do.
I'm covering a whole lot of material in a short period of
you
time.
Are.
This is a lifetime study.
So let's see if I can get this straight.
Okay.
Are you saying that the information, this information from cave number 7, predates the writings in the Bible, or are you saying it postdates the writings?
Okay, I see. What I described earlier, when I was talking about the services and the communal religious activities of the Nazarenes being 200 years older than Christianity, I was describing Jewish rites, R-I-T-E-S, that were being practiced. That would be the Messianic meal of bread and wine, which was practiced 200 years before the Lord's Supper. Baptism for the Remission of Sins. That's 200 years before John the Baptist came on the scene. This is what major scholars in the field believe, because they want to distance everything that was happening at Qumran from Christianity. The holding all things in common, which you find in the Book of Acts, the early Christians held all things in common, and they had to, or they didn't join the group. That was practiced by the Essenes. There were major punishments for people who did not toe the line and did not obey the Mekbakar, which was the bishop. Okay, now, Cave 7 is different from this material. And it's almost as though Cave 7 is a totally separate from the Qumran Essene experience. Cave 7 could very well be, according to the material that I've read, a cave that was occupied by or briefly visited by a group of Christians or a family of Christians who happened to have had the Greek Bible with them, parts of the Septuagint are found there, and many parts of what is now the modern Greek New Testament, written by the early apostles of Jesus. Now, that could have been hidden there, you know, probably any time, but they were definitely Greeks, or at least Greek-speaking Jews. I would say they're probably Greek-speaking Jews or Greeks who were Judaized and were carrying with them scriptures of the Greek-Jewish religion of that time, which was becoming more and more Gentilized, and they got caught there, had to leave their manuscripts in the cave, move on, or for some reason, maybe they were killed, or maybe they went there and died for some reason. Who knows?
So are you suggesting, or am I inferring from this that someone knew if there's a Cave 7, and we find this information in them, then are we going to suppose that these people knew where the other scrolls were?
No, you mean the people that were in Cave 7, the original people,
right,
that lost the Greek manuscript?
Yeah.
It's not known. It's unusual because in this one cave, of the 11 caves that are known, Cave 7 has only Greek manuscripts. Now, if they were part of the Essene community, they would have had other manuscripts. They would have had the Manual of Discipline. They would have had the Messianic Rule. They would have had what's called the Thanksgiving hymns. We should probably discuss those, because there's very little about Thanksgiving in the Thanksgiving hymns. That was just a name given to those psalms. They would have had stuff that was more specifically sectarian and Essene, whereas it appears among the fragments that have been translated and looked at by scholars that these are all scriptures of the Greek New Testament church. And it's at a very early time, which would estimated now at 70, at the very latest, maybe 70 A.D. Maybe.
So this is essentially a lot of
35 A.D.
This is a lot of the Bible in pristine condition, then.
Pristine. No, little fragments. We're talking.
Well,
I'm looking at a picture of a Greek manuscript now, and I just see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 words.
Well, pristine meaning that those five words at least never went through a non-translation.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. And these five words fit the two verses in the New Testament in the book of Mark, the Gospel of Mark, chapter 6, 52-53. Those words fit there really nicely. They're right where they should be.
So the fundamentalists get to strike one for themselves.
Yeah. Normally, I would not give anything to fundamentalists. I am not a fundamentalist. I'm not even a Christian. I'm not affiliated with any religion. They could pick up this ball and run with it if they knew about it. I don't think they know about it because, you know, fundamentalists don't read, you know, Biblical Archaeology Review, really. I mean,
really?
Probably some do. But Biblical Archaeology Review and Bible Review are so liberal and written by scholars who are way and above not being fundamentalists that they wouldn't know about it.
Generally. All right, so basically, what we're looking at then is we're looking at information that has been left out of the Bible. Some of it's been corroborated in the Bible. Stories have been either changed or mistakes have been made. What is your take on this whole thing at this point? What do you think can be done? And I tell you what, we have about a minute and a half to start that, and then we'll continue it.
Okay. What's been found out about the Bible is that the Essenes, like I told you before, had all of the books of the Old Testament except for the book of Esther. What scholars in the Bible have discovered is that the Essene material differs from the received Hebrew text called the Masoretic text in ways that support the other two major translations of the Bible, namely the Septuagint and the Samaritan version of the Old Testament. The Samaritans, by the way, only have the first five books of the Moses, whereas the Septuagint has all of the other books of the Bible, plus what's called the Apocrypha, and those are considered biblical to the Greek-speaking Jews. But the Apocrypha part of the Old Testament was not included in the final canon by the Masoretes in Yavne in 90 AD because they didn't consider them authentic enough or important enough to be in the new canon of the Hebrew Bible. Does that help?
Dr. Snow, tell me, are there any other caves?
Yes, there are. There are four new caves that are being explored this month in Israel. And the Israel Antiquities government organization, it's called Israel Antiquities Authority, is hoping to find more Qumran-oriented material. Hopefully some more artifacts and some more of the literature of the first century Judaism.
Okay, I want to go to the book your church doesn't want you to read. I blew
okay.
that one. You have a very interesting article in here, and I just want to talk about the star prophecy, because lots of people talk about astrology. A lot of fundamentalists really say that astrology certainly is the work of the devil, and yet it appears that in the story of the birth of Christ, we have astrologers finding him. So maybe you could tell us about that.
Okay, in the Bible story, nice Christmas story, you have astrologers who, and this is, they didn't used to call them astrologers, they used to call them magi, which were the nicest way you could probably refer to them as the drug dealers of the time. This is the way the scholar John Allegro refers to them in his book Dead Sea Scrolls and the Christian Myth. These people were selling herbs and spices and drugs, and they were astrologers. They would tell you your horoscope. And having a horoscope at that time was not that unusual. Even King Herod at that time had his astrologers who told him, according to a certain star, the Messiah is supposed to be born about this time. Well, the Essenes out there 15 miles outside of Jerusalem, and like I said before, I can't emphasize it enough, Qumran was close to Jerusalem. You could walk between Qumran and Jerusalem in one day. It wasn't a big deal. Everybody was into astrology at that time. It was a major way to look at the skies. They were fatalistic. The Qumranites, the Nazarenes, the Notzri Habrit, all these words referring to the same organization, believed that the stars told the will of God. And they at night they would go out and they'd look up in the sky and they would see the same stars that they knew told the future. And as in heaven, so on earth. This is the ancient Babylonian religion of the stars that was adopted by the Jews when they were in Babylon. They just took it for granted. So they'd go out, and they had the zodiac, which is very similar to the Babylonian zodiac, and they had it distributed over the days of the month, and they also included natural phenomena that could, like thunder. That's why they're called Brontologion, which means great thunder, in the sections on the Dead Sea Scrolls that cover the astrology and the horoscopes. They believe that those were also part of predicting the future. What sounds came with the stars, which were in the sign of the twins, and so on. For example, one of the astrological texts in the scroll says, "If it thunders in the sign of the twins, terror and distress caused by foreigners." Well, that's an astrological prediction. It's taken for granted. They believed it. They had a code of their own devising that that they used for telling personal horoscopes. I read in the Dead Sea Scrolls, Reappraisal by John Allegro. He was one of the original Dead Sea Scroll editors before he became an arch heretic and decided to go public with everything he knew, and then became an outcast. He wrote about astrology in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and the characteristics that if one was born under a certain influence of the heavenly bodies, they had certain physical and spiritual characteristics, and he talked about how the zodiac was used. Thus, for example, a person born under Taurus, the bull, will have long and lean thighs, narrow toes, and a humble demeanor. He will have inherited a balance of good spirit against bad in the proportion of 6 to 3. On the other hand, a rascal, cursed with a proportion of 8 parts of bad spirits to only 1 of good, may be expected to display a somewhat coarse appearance with broad, hairy thighs, blah, blah, blah. It goes on and on like that. That's the way their horoscopes read. And it was meaningful to them at the time.
So,
any questions?
Yeah, I want to come back to the story of the birth of Jesus then.
Okay. Jesus, born, it was expected that the Messiah was going to be born at about that time. Since I don't read astrological signs, that deeply, I can't tell you, where, why certain constellations should be and what sign and what it would mean, blah, blah, blah. None of that stuff, interests me personally. But it was believed that
Well, for example, how did anyone ever come up with the idea that it was born? I mean, I have heard that the purpose of having Christmas on the 25th of December occurred because that was a pagan holiday.
Oh, of course. Yeah, that was that's another gift from Constantine. This is an idea that I like to throw out to the general public. If Constantine had not made Christianity the religion of the Roman Empire, and if he had made, say, the religion of Mithra the religion of the Roman Empire, we would still have basically the same universal Catholic Church. Instead of Christ, we'd have Mithra. We would still have his birthday being on December 25th, and we'd still be celebrating it with a tree that has astrological orbs in it, planetary orbs in it, which are the bulbs, and we'd have the lights of the stars in it, like I have in front of me right now, and it'd be decorated with all the kind of good things. We'd have basically the same, resurrection day, and we'd have the same feast days, and everything would be pretty much the same. I think we'd still have monks and nuns in the monasteries. All of that stuff is so universal. I don't think we would have anything different today if Constantine had chosen another religion.
So that's
because almost everything in Christianity that is Christianity today is certainly not first century Judaism up to the year 135 AD when Bar Kokhba was defeated by the Romans. What we have in Christianity today is borrowed from all the pagan religions surrounding Judea at that time. The priesthood, the Pope in Rome, he's called the Pontifex Maximus. Where did that term come from? That's what the Emperor of Rome was called. He was the high priest of the pagan empire, Pontifex Maximus. Now the Pontifex Maximus is the Pontiff of Rome, the Holy Father in Rome. That's what the Roman Emperor was called, the Holy Father. He never called anybody the Holy Father in ancient Judaism. I don't even think they called God Father, but it wasn't ever anything like that.
Well, that's incredible. I mean, you're basically saying that the entire situation is all Constantine's creation.
I think that the religion has evolved into what we have today, namely Christianity in all its major cults and sects and denominations. I think we would have had all that anyway, no matter what would have happened. Even if Constantine had chosen Zoroastrianism, and we were worshiping the god of light and the god of darkness, Ahura Mazda and his opposite, we would still have the same priesthood, the same temples, the same celebrations. It all would have borrowed from each other. Everything would have been borrowed from existing religious customs throughout the world, and it all would have worked together to what we have today.
What a mishmash!
Yeah,
it's incredible.
See the evolution of religious doctrine. Like the idea of let's go back to the Qumran community having the service of bread and wine, which is a symbolic feast of the Messiah, and whenever 10 got together to celebrate a meal. They were to celebrate the coming of the Messiah with the bread and wine. Now, the idea of drinking blood and eating the body of a god, that's totally pagan. That's incredible. No Orthodox Jew at that time, including Jesus, would even have suggested eating my flesh, drinking my blood, as it's recorded today in the New Testament. That's straight Mithra. That's what was done in the pagan religions. They were eating the body and the blood of Dionysius and Mithra and all these other gods and goddesses. You know, this is the way they communed with their god. This isn't authentic Jewish Christianity. It's not authentic Judaism. It's a late theology that's evolved out of a defeated Judea, and it evolved into a what's called in theological literature today a permitted religion, a religion that's permitted to exist. And Christianity, after St. Paul, you know, allowed so many pagans to come into his branch of Judaism, his branch eventually evolved into Christianity, which was taken over and adopted by the pagan Emperor Constantine and made the universal religion of Rome. That's why it's so big today.
All right. Now, what I want to know now is this. You looked over the story in Time Magazine, Is the Bible Fact or Fiction? And, of course, their answer was that it's a little bit of both, and then nobody knows what the percentage is. According to you, there's a bigger percentage of myth and fiction here than there is truth, isn't there?
Yes. What was brought out in the magazine was that the idea of Moses was probably not historical. You know, none of the stuff in the Bible that we have in the Bible today, and I mean in the Torah, which is very basically, this is the early stuff, the stories of the patriarchs and of Moses and the coming out of Egypt, all of that stuff was written after the time of Solomon. You know, before that, you had stories that were told by word of mouth. And this is pretty much covered in a textbook that anybody could get in the public library today called The Book of Jay. It's by Harold Bloom. And it tells how in 950, between 900 and 950 B.C., before Christ, you know, the Book of Jay was put down, which is like basic little stories of Yahweh. And, you know, Yahweh walked and talked with Adam and Eve, and Yahweh walked and talked with Abraham, and then got mad at Abraham and threw something at him, and then Yahweh got hungry and fell down and fell asleep.
Dr. Alan Snow is probably one of the most, foremost authority on the Dead Sea Scrolls. We left off with the stories of Yahweh.
Okay, the stories of Yahweh were like children's stories, and I told you before, Yahweh was like a great big giant. You know, he was a man who had appetites. He got hungry. He fell asleep. He would get mad. He would ask Abraham to do weird things like go sacrifice your son, you know, which is a pretty barbaric and mean thing to do. And then he would change his mind about things. You know, he would, you know, make a decision here and then let somebody else talk him out of it, and then he would relent. You know, this is all very, very human. These stories were put down in what's called the Book of J. J is a letter that stands for Yahweh. It's the German J. Okay, that book was written around 900 or 950 B.C. That's before Christ, right after the reign of Solomon. So, you know, you don't have any scriptures before Solomon written down. You have David. David's found in some of the archaeological digs. You know, the House of David. Lots of that's been made public in the newspaper and in archaeology magazines. But getting back to the Bible, okay, you have these children's stories, basically children's stories of Yahweh being put down. Then you know you have the temple, the Yahweh cult, which is what we learned about in seminary. I went to school theology at Claremont. And we learned about the Yahweh cult that was popular during the time of David and Solomon, and the stories of Yahweh were passed down. By the time 800 to 850, 100 years later, you have the Elohist stories. Now the Elohim are the you know, the gods and goddesses of the land at that time. The
right,
Elohim,
which
the word Elohim is plural.
Right, yep. Which brings me to, you know, one of the most controversial verses in the Bible, which is the one where instead of it doesn't really say that God made man in His image. It
made
says
our image,
right? The Elohim.
Yeah, you have the Elohim. You have the gods. You have a plural entity here,
mm-hmm.
making man in a plural image.
Right.
Okay, so we have the Elohim, which is a plural word. But, I used to go to temple, when I was studying Hebrew. I used to go to temple on Friday night, and I read all this stuff in Hebrew, and Elohim would be one of the names of God. Even though everybody there knows it's a plural word, it was still one of the names of God. Well, you have the combination of the Elohim stories and the Elohim stories being added to the Yahweh stories. So you have the scriptures growing. And then by the year 500, 550 B.C., you have what's called the P-text. The P-text are the priestly sections that were added to the written scriptures at that time. And the priestly group is getting to be more and more powerful. And they're rebuilding the temple, 520 to 515. They rebuild the temple. It was destroyed by the Babylonians. You remember that, the fall of Jerusalem.
This has been incredible. We haven't had a chance to really do everything. You started talking about now the Book of the P.
Yeah, that's the priestly documents.
All right. Thank you so much for being with me.
All right.
Thank you all for listening to Timeless Voyager Radio. We will be back tomorrow night. Good night.